I think one of the things that one we now understand, both about the Soviet Union in the 1930s under Stalin, and as we will see when we turn our attention to the Third Reich under the Nazis, was that the regime certainly possessed this system of terror. The secret police was always, there was a sense that the secret police was always there, the eyes and ears of the secret police ready to listen in on your discussions with your neighbors or even with your family. But it also created an atmosphere in which people were encouraged to denounce their neighbors. And people also instrumentalized the system. They came to understand that you could make a private accusation against your neighbor for counter-revolutionary thoughts, counter-revolutionary actions. And people within the Soviet Union, as they would do in Nazi Germany, found ways to, as I would put it, instrumentalize the system. You had a neighbor whose dog barked too much in the night. You had a neighbor who'd crossed you about this, that, or the other over the past. You could make an anonymous denunciation to the police or to the party. It might not lead to a conviction, but it created an atmosphere in the Soviet Union in the 1930s of everyone watching everyone else. Not simply the state or the party from above, but rather your neighbors. And in some cases, family members also watching, listening. It is also, I think, the pervasive sense of really paranoia at the highest levels of the regime that is also striking about this period in the Soviet Union, a sense that there were enemy agents everywhere, that the forces of imperial capitalism were everywhere ready to undermine the regime. And if those forces weren't bad enough, then there was the left opposition, or there was the right opposition. The shifting lines of ideological purity meant that one always had to try to anticipate, to be on the right side. It was a regime which made a claim not only to one's public behavior, but also to private, and encouraged the atomization of Russian society. Where the only adhesive binding Soviet society together would be the party, the regime itself. The purges were hardly then limited to these show trials of 1937-1938. Although the numbers remain hotly debated, it is conservatively estimated that millions were either executed or sent to forced labor camps during this period. In 1937-1938, Stalin even turned on the military and began a major purge of the Red Army. Not only were top military commanders purged, but thousands of officers, down to literally the company level. 35,000 officers, fully one half of the Soviet officer corps, were executed or imprisoned in 1937 and 1938. It dealt, many believed, around Europe to a devastating blow to the efficiency of and the effectiveness of the Red Army. This would come into play, as we will see, in German calculations and Nazi calculations about the ability of the Soviet Union to defend itself. But once again, it was to remove possible sources of opposition to Stalin and the regime, and also to place representatives of the party, Stalin's representatives, all the way down to the company level within the Red Army. 8.5 million people were arrested by the regime in 1937-1938. The numbers are not yet clear, and there are fierce debates about this, though as we gain access to the files, the papers of the Soviet regime from this period, the numbers tend to move up and up. But it is estimated that perhaps as many as 1 million people were shot in between 1937 and 1938 in the midst of these purges. Half the membership of the Communist Party, 1.2 million people, were arrested, 600,000 executed, while others died in labor camps. All told, the death toll from Stalin's purges and the policy of forced collectivization of agriculture between 1929 and 1939 run as high as 20 million people.